Hello, this is Playback Daily for Thursday, the 12th of June. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up on the show.
For young girls and boys, but also for adults, I often think there was so many adults over the years have come to me and said, Nora, you're doing what I've always wanted to do, but I never got the chance.
And that's when all of this happened. So it's shattered dreams for Annie, for her parents. And we know somebody's responsible for that and has been got away with it for so long. But hopefully not much longer.
And then when you're putting in your basil pesto, instead of using all basil, because again, basil is like one basil plant, if you buy it in the supermarket, will get you one jam jar portion of pesto. That's how I do it. I wash out my jam jars, save them. Everything is stored in glass jars because everything lasts longer.
On Morning Ireland, we heard the breaking news that a man has been arrested in connection with the murder of Annie McCarrick, the 26-year-old American woman who went missing 32 years ago. Here's Paul Williams, RTE crime correspondent, talking to Samantha Librari.
Well, Samantha, this man is in his 60s. He was arrested by detectives from the Serious Crime Unit in Irish Town in West Dublin this morning. He's been arrested on suspicion of murder. I understand he was an associate of Annie McCarrick at the time. He knew her, and he has been a person of interest in this investigation for some time. He's been detained under Section 4 of the Criminal Justice Act and can be questioned for up to 24 hours. Now, Gardaí are also searching a house in Clondalkin in West Dublin as part of this investigation. They say that the search has been carried out by the South Central Divisional Search Team, supported by the Garda National Technical Bureau. They say it has the support of other state agencies and external expertise if that is required. They've also imposed a temporary restricted airspace in the area this morning. And this is the first arrest in this investigation.
This is the first ever arrest, is it, Paul, despite the cold case examination?
Yeah, I mean, people remember Annie McCarrick was originally from New York. She lived in St. Catherine's Court in Sandy Mount in Dublin, and she went missing on the 26th of March 1993. The last confirmed sighting of her was captured on CCTV shortly before 11 o'clock that morning. That was at the AIB Bank on Sandy Mount Road, and people will remember those images. There were also reported sightings of her in Sandy Mount, in the Sandy Mount Green area, boarding a number 44 bus to Enniskerry at the Johnny Fox's pub. When she came to Ireland, she'd settled in Sandy Mount and she worked as a waitress in the Courtyard restaurant in Donnybrook and in the Cafe Java in Leeston Street. She had bought groceries on the morning of her disappearance on the 26th of March 1993 in the local shopping centre Quinsworth on Sandy Mount Road, and that was confirmed by a receipt that was found in unpacked shopping bags which were later found in her apartment. She was reported missing 2 days later by a friend. Now, initially this case was treated as a missing persons inquiry, but it has been reviewed over the years, particularly by the Garda Serious Crime Review Team, the so-called Cold Case Unit. And 2 years ago, it was upgraded to a murder inquiry, and a number of lines of inquiry were reactivated as the Garda went back over all the details of the case. And there was a person of interest identified, and the Garda obviously feel this morning they have enough information gathered and evidence gathered to put this suspect, who has now been arrested on suspicion of murder, is now in a Garda station and being detained and questioned.
And Annie McCarrick, it's arguably one of the most well-known missing person cases in the state. There's been huge publicity, as you say, with those renewed appeals for information in recent years. Is that likely to have led to where Gardaí are today?
Yeah, I mean, obviously developments in the case, they've consistently over the years appealed for information and for people to come forward, and it's clear that they have developed lines of inquiry and got their information and their evidence to such a standard that they believe that they can carry out this arrest. And it's an arrest on suspicion of murder. There are other missing persons cases which have also been upgraded to murder. We know the case of Jojo Dollard, for example. There was an arrest in that case, and there is a suspect in that case as well, and that investigation is continuing. I mean, in these cases, most recently, for example, if you look at the case of Tina Satchwell, that was originally a missing persons inquiry, subsequently upgraded to murder. A second search was carried out, new evidence was gathered, and then a successful prosecution in this case. So the Gardaí will always make the case that they don't give up on these cases. They keep their appeals for information. They keep searching for new evidence. They've clearly got new evidence in this case, which has enabled them to mount an arrest of a suspect who's now been questioned this morning.
Paul Williams on Morning Ireland, and later Claire Byrne led with the story and spoke to RTE's Mick Pilo, who made a documentary about Annie McCarrick's disappearance.
Mick,
you, people might remember, you along with producer John Downes, you made a two-part documentary called Beyond the Vanishing Triangle, The Search for Annie McCarrick. And we wanted just to talk to you this morning about the case because you know it so well. I mean, this is a significant moment, isn't it, in this decades-long investigation?
Yes, it sure is, Claire. Good morning. We looked into the investigation itself into the disappearance of Annie McCarrick. What did the Gardaí investigate, actually? Because the narrative has been, if you just go back to 1993 and imagine 32 years ago, Ireland was perceived as an idyllic country where tourists or people can come from wherever, particularly America, and they can feel safe there. And when Annie McCarrick disappeared, you had this 26-year-old beautiful she captured the imagination of the country because she was this beautiful character, gentle woman who everyone loved, who talked to everybody, and she literally disappeared off the face of the earth. And I suppose there was a sense that the country was shattered and said, oh my God, we are we the type of country that people can't come here and be safe? Mm-hmm. And I suppose it shattered that for us. That was the first thing. Thousands of people came out searching for her. There was a narrative out there, which was the narrative the Gardaí at the time were looking at. And that's what we began to investigate with the Gardaí who investigated the case. And the narrative was simply that Annie was last seen in the bank. We have CCTV footage of in the bank at 11 o'clock in Sandymouth where she lived. She went shopping. There's a receipt for the shopping she went. She went home to her home in Sandymouth. It was an apartment. And she literally disappeared. But there was a sighting of her on a 44 bus going to Enniskerry. She was known to have gone to Enniskerry a couple of times to Johnny Fox's pub because Americans and Irish people like to go to Johnny Fox's pub. And there was a sighting by the doorman there of her in Johnny Fox's pub. So that was the information. That was the information that was available. And we basically spoke to the family and all of Annie's friends and the investigating Gardaí. And that narrative wasn't the narrative really that we felt was the right narrative. There was something missing out of all of that narrative. And the family felt, why has this not been a murder investigation? We sent the Gardaí, investigating Gardaí, information in 1993 in faxes. That information should have raised a red flag for them. That information said things like, Annie told her auntie in confidence that a man she knew had hit her and she was a little concerned about that relationship. So that information was there. The Gardaí did not, the investigating did not have that information. Mm-hmm. And so that was a bit shocking. The family then, Annie's mother, Nancy, wrote to the commissioner during our investigation requesting that it be upgraded to a murder case. And during our documentary research and before it went out on air, it was upgraded to a murder case. And I think that has changed everything because, as we know, in recent times, when cases have been upgraded to murder, the guards have much more powers. They can actually investigate much better. They can actually go into houses and dig up back gardens or whatever else. They have the power to do that. They don't have the power to do that in a missing case.
And it changes things in terms of resources as well, doesn't it, Nick?
Absolutely.
Powers and resources. It's huge.
Yeah, absolutely huge. And I think this is going to be such good news for Nancy McCarrick, who all she wants to do is to bring her daughter home. To bury her in a grave. And I think, you know, that's all she needs to put closure on this. Mm-hmm. She's not looking for a murderer. And the other thing, I suppose, that beyond the Vanishing Triangle was looking at this notion where women were disappearing in around Wicklow, what we call the Vanishing Triangle. Around that period of time, a number of women, Jojo Dollard, Fiona Sinnott, Fiona Pender, there's a number of cases we all know about, and we're hearing about them on the news now as well. And I suppose there was a sense there's a serial killer out there, you know, and that fitted a narrative, that suited the narrative, but in a way to us that was a red herring. In a way, all of these cases, and the Gardaí know this, most of these cases we know, it's somebody closer to home that's responsible for these murders. And I think that's going to be clear in this case as well.
Well, look, we'll see. As we know, an arrest has just been made today. And just going back to Nancy McCarrick, who I know you met, Mick, didn't you? Didn't you travel to her house?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
As part of the work you did for the documentary. And you described that house as a house full of memories. And so, I mean, we wonder how the family are feeling today with this news and these new developments.
Yes, I wanted to ring Nancy, but it's too early in the morning.
Yeah.
But the sense is, sure, Nancy still has Annie's jumpers, you know, the sweaters from the Aaron sweaters. She still has books from her. She still has her diaries. I mean, I got to know Nancy, and the kind of work we do, so privileged work. You get into families, you get to know these people intimately. And they almost become family. And so it's just such a tremendous good news that she no longer, she's been waiting and waiting. And it's a hell of a wait.
Yeah,
but
we don't know what the outcome of this is going to be, and we don't want to get their hopes up too much either. But people might remember back in 1993 when Annie first went missing, and an awareness grew amongst her friends that there was something wrong here. You can imagine that phone call going to Nancy. And I think the friend said to Nancy, "Have you heard from Annie?" And I think she nearly booked her flight or began the process before she ended that phone call.
Yes, she did, because she knew something was gone. Something was gone awry. She knew there was a problem. And she just a mother's sense. Now, Annie, just so you know, Annie is an only child. You know, she was the apple of her father's eye, of her mother's eye. They were letting her go to Ireland to live. It was a huge letting go, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, that was very, very painful. In a way, that never really happened. You know, the way it takes time for a mother and father to let their children go, even as adult children. But an only child, you let her go because that's what she wants to do, but she never comes back. And they were in that process of letting go, which is a huge process. And that process has been ongoing. John died without ever coming to a conclusion around that. That process, in some way, Nancy has got to a place where she has let her go. She just has realised she's not coming back. And I think that is as a huge realisation for her as well. But I do think she's hopeful. And that's an extraordinary thing. And to be so hopeful. And nothing may come of this, you know, nothing may come of it at all. But, she, you know, I think in some way there's hope. And that's mm-hmm. the most important thing.
And Annie's connection to Ireland, she came here on a school tour and sort of fell in love with the country and then came back to complete her studies or to do some third level studies here, Mick. Is that right?
Yes. She basically came over with her, I think, an uncle of hers on a school trip. And she, when she came back on the school trip, she said to her parents, "When I'm finished, I'm going to go to college, going to Ireland, and going to live there." So she came over with a view to doing a course of teacher training in Drumcondra. That didn't work out. She then tried she started a course in Maynooth and was doing German and something else in Maynooth, I think German and English. And that's when she stopped that studies and went back home for a period of time and came back to complete that. And get the money to complete that. And that's when she had a job as a waitress, trying to get the money to go to college in Maynooth. And that's when all of this happened. So it's shattered dreams for Annie, for her parents. And we know somebody's responsible for that and has been got away with it for so long. But hopefully not much longer.
RTE's Mick Pilo on Today with Claire Byrne. Shea Byrne was in for Oliver Callan this morning and his guest was Dr. Nora Patton, Irish aeronautical engineer, who'll make history by becoming the first Irish person to go into space.
We've had such a busy time. We've been back at the National Research Council in Canada last August to do more microgravity research flights. We had an open call for science for our space flight. The down select has been happening the last few months, and we'll be announcing a lot more.
The down select.
So yeah, stay tuned. We'll be announcing a lot more about the research we'll be doing on our flight in the next few weeks.
So this differentiates from what we might call a space tourism flight. Like there was some of those more recently, which are another commercial venture and developing space travel. But this is actually a scientific trip.
Correct, yes. So ours is it's a research space flight on a commercial spacecraft. So people might have heard of the space tourism flights. Ours is a research flight. So we'll be flying with Virgin Galactic. And I'll be flying with two colleagues, Dr. Shauna Pandya and Kelly Girardi from our Research Institute, IIAS. Kelly actually flew as our first researcher in 2023, November 2023. She was the first from her institute to fly. So we're IIAS 02. And really our hope is with the, expansion and evolution of the commercial space flights, we're going to develop a pipeline. So we'd love to have multiple research flights from our institute. It really feeds into IIAS's values to democratize science, to open up the doors for emerging space nations. For Ireland, First of Nation flight, it's just such a huge deal and a huge opportunity. So I think IIAS really sees the value and the impact that they're having.
I suppose to explain, most people would know the NASA model, where NASA does the research, builds the spacecraft up to recently, because they've obviously been using Elon Musk's spacecraft, and then they fly and come back and recover, etc., with the Navy. But this is a different model. The Institute essentially charters a spacecraft. Is that right? From Virgin Atlantic, or Virgin Galactic.
Galactic. Through IIAS, we have secured research seats with Virgin Galactic. Yeah. So our training and our preparation is all done through our research institute, and then we'll fly as researchers on board Virgin Galactic's next generation spacecraft, which is called Delta.
So it's brand new, I believe.
Yes, correct. So actually this time last year, I was in Spaceport America for the final commercial flight of Unity, which was Virgin Galactic's first first commercial spacecraft. And, it was just really incredible to be on site, to see the launch, to see the setup, to meet some of the people, to see the research, and to see how the whole thing operates. So I came away from that trip so much more excited about, me flying on that vehicle in the next few years. Well, not that particular vehicle, but their next generation vehicle in the next few years.
And the advances that you'll see there as well. Will there be other institutes there, other researchers from different parts of the world on that same flight doing experiments?
So with our open call for science, we'll be announcing more about that in the next few weeks. But our goal and our ambition is to maximise the potential and maximise the outputs and the impact in terms of the research. So the plan is to collaborate with many different researchers so we can do a variety of experiments on the flight.
It sounds like you're all over the world. Do you get back home or do you work from home? Do you do hybrid working? How do you do it? That's expensive to do that.
I'm Dublin based. Okay. Yeah, so I live here, based here. I work for a company, a space company called Railtra in Dublin. So that's brilliant because we make spaceflight hardware. So I'm really in the thick of it. I get to understand, how we develop technologies that fly on launchers. And it's really interesting because, it's everything from the design, the engineering, the planning, the qualifications. So all of the testing, the hardware has to go through to be flight ready. It's brilliant because I've been part of the space community for many years. And really when I graduated, I won't say how many years ago now, but there really wasn't many opportunities in Ireland to work in the space sector.
Yeah.
But that has changed, and it's been really phenomenal the last 10 years to see the growth of the industry and the opportunities for Irish industry to get involved. And even at Railtra, we take on interns over the summer. These interns are coming in from university. They're getting to handle and work with flight hardware, which is phenomenal. You don't always get that opportunity. I think the next 5 to 10 years is going to be a very exciting time in the industry.
And there have been, I remember hearing about Ireland has a satellite now.
Yes, AirSat 1. So that was led through UCD and that launched about 18 months ago. So again, another, you know, big milestone for Ireland. But I think it shines the conversation on the possibilities. So many researchers and industries got to collaborate to develop AirSat 1. So, yeah, it's, you know, those things are celebratory milestones.
They are. They're huge because we had to rent space before from different people and they were in control of our destiny as such. Now we have our own.
Yeah, I think it comes back to, there's so many layers to it. It's, you know, on the commercial side, there's an economic advantage to being involved in the space sector. Global space economy is worth about $600 billion, forecast to reach a $1 trillion industry in the next decade or less. So, you know, where as a nation do we want to stand? Do we want to be part of that industry or not? So the likes of AirSat 1 was great in terms of upskilling researchers, you know, people to really get to know what it takes to send things to space. And even in Railtra, a number of the people who worked on AirSat 1 are now working in Railtra. So it's that pipeline feat of qualified, educated people who know the sector.
And that being proud, and I know Aer Lingus has partnered with you. What are they doing for you?
Correct, yeah. So as you mentioned, I do have some travel.
some travel, wow.
Between here and the actual flight, we'll be actually going back to the National Research Council in Canada the end of this month. So I'm very, very proud and delighted to have partnered with Aer Lingus. They're going to be my travel partner as I fly back and forth to North America over the next 18 months to 2 years. Couldn't have hoped for and wished for a better travel partner. I have always flown Aer Lingus where I could have possibly. But yeah, I think it'll make my life a lot easier to have them on board and to just facilitate that travel back and forth.
There's a text in from Shane Cullinan in Cork. My daughter's hero is Nora.
Ah,
she did her sixth class project in Osqueilge on her, and she's loved her since she was small, and she's an inspiration for all young women.
Ah, thank you so much. Nice. That's been phenomenal. I mean, it's been so positive to see the impact and, you know, for young girls and boys, but also for adults. I often think there was so many adults over the years have come to me and said, Nora, you're doing what I've always wanted to do, but I never got the chance.
Yeah.
So I don't for one second take the opportunity I have for granted. And I often say, you know, I know that when I fly to space, I take a lot of hopes and a lot of dreams with me. So I do that, you know, with a lot of pride.
When you were in school, as this young woman was as well, did you put your hand up when people say what you want to be? I want to be a bus driver. I want to be I want to be a pop star. I want to be a film star. Did you say I want to be an astronaut?
I said I want to work in the space sector. I want to have a space career.
Nora, you're 6 years old. What do you want to do? I'd like to work in the space sector. This is in Ballina, where you're from.
I'm in Ballina. So I had an opportunity to visit NASA in Cleveland when I was 11, I was on a family holiday visiting my aunt and my dad's cousins.
Very glamorous. We were in the Isle of Man. Very glamorous.
First time on an aircraft and first time going to the US and my dad's cousin brought us to NASA.
Wow.
And that was just the spark. So yeah, my junior cert art project was rockets, astronauts. My junior cert art teacher was the loveliest man, Mr. McDonough. You know, he'd always say, Nora, you know, he sent me a text after the flight was announced. He said, I never doubted it. That's 25 years later. Yeah, I think most people who know me know that this has been a very long term journey. It's been a very year on year progression. It's been really a case of seeking out every opportunity I could possibly seek out. But equally, I say, you know, I wouldn't sit here and talk about this space flight without all of the people who have supported me and who have helped me and who have believed in me, even, you know, at my research institute.
I suppose most people would have heard of Cape Canaveral or the Kennedy Space Center, but there's a NASA Space Center in Cleveland.
There is, yeah.
How did you end up there?
They have Plumbrook, which is now Armstrong, and they have a huge vacuum chamber for doing testing on, you know, big scale satellites. And then they have a research centre, the Glenn Research Centre in Cleveland, where they do a lot of wind tunnel testing, a lot of different for aircraft and for spacecraft. So my aunt lives in Cleveland. She moved when she was about 19. That's my mom's sister. And then my dad's side of the family, my grandfather's three brothers moved to Cleveland. I was there just recently, was able to get the direct Dublin Cleveland flight, which was phenomenal.
Nice plug.
saved the changeover. But you really kind of turn around in Cleveland without meeting somebody with an Ackle or Mayo connection.
How are you?
Yeah.
How are you, Laura? How's your dad?
It's almost like that.
Yeah. And what's the connection between Cleveland and Ackle? How did that? Is there a lot of? Was there some reason that everybody went there?
I don't know the early origins of it, but Cleveland and Ackle are twinned. So they're twinned.
Oh.
Yes. It goes back probably about 150 years, as far as I know. I don't know the origins of that.
The reason for the
movement.
Yeah.
But I would love to find it out.
Yeah. I know my own family, some people were in Pearl River and then more people went over. They were sponsored by them and over the years and it becomes an enclave. Pearl River is in north of New York.
Okay.
It's the only place of their own football ground, GA ground.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
the Mayo team go over, I think,
to
train there.
That's where that is.
That's where that is.
Very good.
It's a beautiful part of the world.
Oh, I'll have
you ever
to
get
visit.
a chance to go. When you're not in space, like...
When I'm back from space, maybe.
I was looking through Instagram as well. You seem to be, like, it looks, you're doing weightless training as well. So it looks like you're in space all the time, but they're not spacecraft that you're in.
No, so that's the microgravity research flights we do at the National Research Council in Canada. So they're in Ottawa and it's a Falcon 20 jet. So it's a single aisle, small aircraft with about 8 seats for researchers on board. These are the ideal test bed for us to prepare ourselves and our research and our experiments before we go to space.
Okay.
So I'll be heading back there at the end of this month again, collaborating and working with Shauna and Kelly and Dr. Aaron Prasad, who leads our campaign. But you get about 20 seconds of weightlessness per parabola, and you could get about 10 to 15 of these per flight.
So these are the,
just
like,
to give you a sense,
like a waveform up and down. So they go up at a very high speed and then they drop.
Correct.
The aircraft gets to an apex at the top of the graph as such, drops off, and then you become weightless.
Exactly.
Known as the vomit comet, if I'm not wrong.
Correct, yes. I often say to kids, you know, if what's another name? And then you say the vomit comet, they all start laughing. But
because, you know, people get air sick and the car sick. What's it like falling off the top of a cliff and becoming weightless, literally?
So the aircraft is in free fall. So it's near free fall is the environment you're in, and that gives you the weightlessness.
Terminal velocity.
It's literally the aircraft is dropping out of the sky. So the aircraft is producing no lift and the engines counteract the drag. So you get that free fall motion where everything floats. And it is called the vomit comet because people can get motion sick on board. It's often the change between the microgravity and then you pull into a 1.8 kind of 2G pull out. So everything becomes heavy. So you're going through these transitions of weightlessness to kind of a heavy feeling. So
my father used to, when we were going to Clarehead, we were going to Termonfeckin, there's a humpback bridge there, and he used to speed the car up, the Volkswagen Beetle, so that we'd all feel a bit weightless as you went.
You do. So that's actually, that is weightless. You're feeling.
That's your stomach.
That is exactly it, but you're getting just a microsecond. So you, in an aircraft, you can actually get the 20 seconds of that sensation.
So did you starve yourself for 3 days or what do you do?
No, absolutely not. With not eating, you're more likely to get sick. So I have it down to a fine art now. Plain chicken wrap about 2.5 hours before I fly and I'm perfect.
Are you saying you have a chicken fillet roll? Essentially. Is that what you're having?
There's no spars in Canada or in Ottawa.
But essentially, that's a chicken fillet roll, essentially. I'm telling everybody.
Plain chicken wrap.
Would you have any coleslaw? Or?
No, ease off the mayonnaise. I made that mistake once. Well, not to be made again.
No details to be given. So just tell us again, what date are you flying?
So our flight manifest, it's still as per the press release that we announced when we announced the flights last year. Our flight is anticipated to take place within the first 12 months of commercial operation of Delta, that's Virgin Galactic's next generation spacecraft, and it's still on track to begin commercial operation in 2026.
So stay tuned. Keep our fingers crossed. Do you mind me just asking, I know you have a daughter as well. She must be very proud.
Leisha, yeah, she's only three.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's great. I mean,
Does she know you're an astronaut?
She speaks about mommy going to space, and she says, oh, me and mommy are astronauts, and she'll get her bunnies and kind of play with them and have two teddies together and play with the rockets and stuff. She is aware, which is just, I just think, how amazing for her generation to watch this happen and for them to see what's possible and to see the opportunities. I'm definitely hoping by the time the flight comes up, she's old enough to remember at least snippets of it.
We're getting a huge reaction to you as well. Were you the Grand Marshal in the St. Patrick's Day Parade?
I was.
Yes, in, we're talking about that.
In Ballina. I also did the Limerick Parade. I have a huge connection with Limerick. In 2019, they had a space-themed parade. So Limerick is my adopted second home.
Do you have a space song that you like? We'll have to play a space song for you on Rising Time next week.
I think Elton John, Bowie, there's a whole load of nice space songs. So I leave it up to you.
That's brilliant. Well, look, thanks for taking the time to come in. It's really, I could talk to you all day.
Thank you
really,
so much.
Really, really enjoyable. And I know you're making time for us and really, really appreciate it. When are you heading back to Canada?
In 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah,
and then the flight will launch from New Mexico.
New Mexico once it launched. But yeah, keep tuned. I'm on Instagram. I'm updating regularly. So yeah, absolutely follow along. I share videos of the microgravity flights and stuff like that. So if
the good
are
ones.
Interested, the good ones, not the ones where people are sick.
Irish aeronautical engineer Dr. Nora Patton chatting to Shea Byrne today. TV chef and food wellness advocate Aisling Larkin joined Claire Byrne to share tips on how to make dips and sauces for a fraction of the cost.
And TV chef Aisling Larkin is here with me now in the studio to take us through some of the ones we can attempt to make ourselves. I say attempt because these for me now are a bit scary because they're fancy, and you brought some lovely ones in, Aisling, and they look a bit fancy, dare I say.
I know, and they sound a little bit fancy, but actually you can strip them back to be quite easy. I think there's two key things. If you can stock up your store cupboard, and I don't mean all in 1 week, like little by little, there's a couple of kind of similar ingredients when we go through them that kind of ping up all the time. And then if you have some sort of a food processor, like just bung it in the food. Like there's no technique to these. It's just bung it in the food processor, job done, or pestle and mortar to do by hand if you want it a little bit chunky, if you didn't have one. I think like being cost effective with them is really, really smart. And you're getting in so many fresh ingredients as well, which is really nice.
Yeah, because I always grab a jar of pesto, sometimes the fresh one, but more often than not, it's a jar for the emergency pasta dinner.
Oh, totally. Thursday night, that's my house.
Yeah.
Thursday night is pesto pasta
done.
Dinner. Well, after swimming, everybody's late. It's what can we get done in 20 minutes? And it's really handy. Look, I suppose I try, if I'm organised enough, sometimes on a Sunday morning, in between kind of football training and a few other things, I kind of find I have an hour or two, and I will do a batch of hummus and a batch of pesto.
Right.
And I know that when they're in the fridge, that dinner, emergency
it's
dinner
done.
Will be done. You can do so many things with pesto and with the hummus when the kids come home from school that have 2 to 4:30, you know, that's snacky time.
I know, ruining their dinner with like slices of bread.
Oh, they just go to the cracker drawer. Mine are just like little cracker fiends. And my always conversation is, put some hummus with that and put a piece of fruit with that. Have your cracker, have your hummus, or your fruit.
Yeah, because you've ticked a mammy box there.
That's it.
Yeah.
So it's, and there's just, they're handy, handy ones to have. The other lovely thing about hummus is, and we see it in the supermarket if you're buying it, are so easy to do at home. Once you get the base recipe right, you can add in little flavours. So, you know, for the ones who maybe are a bit reluctant to try a new flavour or a new colour, things like maybe beetroot or avocado, they're very scary. They're big foods, you know, even to adults sometimes. But or even if you've got them left over from that sustainable perspective, think about there's a few beets left around or there's, you know, half the avocado and it's not quite ripe enough to go in the salad or it's overripe. You can put that in and blitz it into your hummus. And then you've got avocado hummus, you've got beetroot hummus. So
when
it's
you
a
thing.
Lovely. There you go. See, money saving as
well.
Will
you take us through your pesto recipe then, Aisling? How do we do it?
So easy. And again, the traditional recipe is basil. So it's basil pesto is what we are kind of known with. Then you always use pine nuts, parmesan and garlic. So that's it. So you start by blitzing down your parmesan, pine nuts and garlic. Pine nuts are crazy expensive.
They are.
So expensive. Like in restaurants, we're starting, like I do, we do consultancy work, so we move away from pine nuts. You can't afford them. It's not possible. So things like cashew nuts work really well. Or my personal favourite from a cost perspective and a nutrient perspective is sunflower seeds. So cheap in the supermarket.
Great idea.
They're creamy, so they give you that.
So the flavour profile is fine in pesto.
You don't notice the difference.
And the other reason for that is if you want to take it into school, you're not bringing nuts.
Exactly. You're bringing seeds. Isn't it so clever?
Very clever.
Great little win. And then parmesan cheese, again, can be really expensive. And I would always say, like, discernment. If you can buy your 18-month-age parmesan, amazing. But in the supermarket, the alternative is Grand Padano.
Yeah.
Like, it's a cheaper alternative. Mm. It'll do the same job for you. And then when you're putting in your basil pesto, instead of using all basil, because again, basil is like one basil plant, if you buy it in the supermarket, will get you one jam jar portion of pesto. That's how I do it. I wash out my jam jars, save them. Everything is stored in glass jars because everything lasts longer in glass jars. Everything. But a great tip is to mix your basil with a little bit of parsley because it's really cheap. It's much cheaper. Or something like spinach and rocket. Or yeah, like watercress. You know, sometimes we buy the bags of leaves and we might get through the whole bag of spinach.
Yeah, it's a great way to use
them. Put that into your pesto as well.
So you're trying to fool whoever's eating it into thinking this is basil pesto.
Exactly.
And so, but you are putting a bit of basil in there, but you're bulking it up
exactly
with other stuff.
Exactly. So it's more sustainable and it's more cost effective and you're using everything up. And sometimes if basil pesto is a big flavour, by kind of thinning it out a little bit with mm-hmm. the others, it's a milder version of a pesto. And then once that pesto is made, you use it as a sandwich spread. You mix it with mayonnaise so that you can have it as a dip with your chicken tenders. Use it drizzled over your pesto or over your pasta, over pizza, anywhere you can get in. Like, don't let it go to waste once you've made it.
Bake your salmon with a bit on top.
Ooh,
as well. That works
delicious,
well, doesn't it?
Yes. Or another lovely one actually is breadcrumbs. If you know, if you put like a breadcrumb top on chicken or fish,
yeah,
mix the pesto through the breadcrumbs.
Oh, good
and
idea.
Sprinkle that on top.
There
lovely.
You go. So we've all that eaten, so we don't need to know how long it lasts. But
nah,
it is about five to 7 days, but it's long gone
yeah,
before
yeah,
then.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So will we jump to the hummus recipe then?
Mm, I love hummus. Homemade hummus is so easy. And I think hummus has become such a staple for all of us. A quick win. Tin of chickpeas.
Yeah.
Garlic. Lemon juice. Then the interesting ingredient that we might not have heard about is tahini. So tahini is sesame seed paste. It, like up until even a year ago, it was difficult to get it in the supermarket. Now, all of the supermarkets.
Now, why are you adding that in? Is it for the flavour?
Oh, that is it. Without it, it's not hummus. It's bland. It's basically like
blitzed
up chickpeas. And chickpeas don't have a lot of flavour.
Like,
they take flavour. That's why they take salt, garlic, lemon juice really well. So tahini, as I said, is sesame seed paste. And we talk about umami. Umami is when you eat something, you go, oh, this is delicious. Sesame seeds are one of those foods that rank really high for umami. So the more tahini you put in, the better. And a lot of times, if you read a generic recipe online, it'll say one tablespoon to one tin of chickpeas. I am saying put 2 tablespoons or a big heaped one.
Mm-hmm.
That's your flavour. The other thing that a lot of people leave out at home when they make it is cumin. Cumin is not a hot spice. It's that warm, earthy spice. And that's when you taste good hummus, you go, oh, geez, that's lovely. It's the little bit of cumin in it that's really lovely. And the other tip, if you're making it at home, so you're just putting everything in the food processor, garlic, lemon juice, your tahini, your chickpeas, drain them off and rinse them because they come in a lot of salty water. You don't want that extra salt.
So okay,
just rinse,
so rinse your chickpeas
before you put them in. And then my little secret is an ice cube. If you pop in an ice cube, it keeps it really light and fluffy. It almost whips it up and it has the most beautiful texture.
Well, look
texture.
At that.
There you go.
I would never have
one ice cube,
thought of that.
All it takes. And when you make my recipe or you do one at home as an example,
yeah,
to that one tin of chickpeas, I use 4 tablespoons of oil, 4 tablespoons of water. So I'm cutting the fat by a huge amount. So I'm not relying on all fat.
So now I'm wondering with the tahini, can I use sesame oil instead of tahini?
If you were desperately stuck, what I would recommend is peanut butter and a drop of sesame oil.
Mm.
Yeah, because peanut butter will kind of act the same. It'll add the consistency and the texture that you want. And the sesame oil will bring the sesame. But be really careful because sesame oil is quite strong. It's very, very pungent.
Okay, so just stop complicating it, Claire, and
yeah,
buy the tahini.
Buy
it's
the
just something that I never buy, you know, it's not on my list.
I know. So listen, right, with the tahini, and if you do buy it, and I'm kind of digressing a little bit now, but baba ganoush is another dip.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more Middle Eastern one, not one we're hugely familiar with, but I'm always trying to get people to eat 30 plants a week. Baba ganoush is an aubergine dip. So you know our lovely plant, eggplant,
yeah,
aubergine that we don't possibly eat enough of sometimes, roasted in the oven, so cut it in half on tin foil, skin side down, olive oil, scoop with a spoon, just scoop out the filling, mix that exactly like you would do with your hummus, with your tahini, your garlic, your lemon juice.
Okay, because we need to find ways to use up the tahini because it's going to end up in the back of the fridge with the jar of miso paste or something.
No. I've one more for you. I've one more recipe for you while we're on a buzz with tahini. Talk about transitioning. On my Instagram, chickpea and cauliflower air fryer salad. You take a head of cauliflower, you take a tin of chickpeas, put them in your air fryer basket, sprinkle on a little bit of cumin if you have it, if you had onion powder, garlic powder, something like that. But even if you just have cumin, that's okay, and oil. 20 minutes in your air fryer, take them out. In a separate little bowl or all over it, drizzle your tahini, olive oil, fresh squeeze of lemon juice.
Sounds delicious.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And like, we tend to eat less cauliflower in the summer because it's not cauliflower cheese, or it's not, you know, the roast dinners we kind of tend to leave off. It's a fabulous way to do a lovely tahini
and we do
dressing.
Need new ways to eat cauliflower because it's so available to us, because it's, you know, we grow it here. There's loads of it.
See it
in the supermarket. Sometimes, like cabbage,
That's it. And the price difference in the supermarket versus the imported ones wrapped in plastic and the Irish one that doesn't come in plastic, it's half the price for cauliflower. You'd pay like €1, €1.50 for it. Like, unbelievably valuable for such a good vegetable, you know, and a real nutrient-dense vegetable that kind of fills you up, which is what you want at lunchtime.
Find new ways to eat cauliflower. What about the cauliflower leaves? Haven't you a way to use those as well?
Yes, in the pesto.
Now we really are fooling people here with our pesto, aren't we?
I know, but you can use them. And actually, if you go on my website, one of the recipes I have, it's an alternative one, but it's like the kind of the sustainable one. You can use the cauliflower leaves, or what I do is sometimes if you're doing like a stir fry and you want to fry off like a couple of greens like bok choy, spinach, those cauliflower leaves work beautifully. Sauteed off, a little bit of
oil. They're very tough though, are they?
You've got to cut the stalk out. Just take the stalk out and then shred them up just like you would like your little cabbage leaves.
Right.
And they cook really quickly. Lovely, a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of sea salt,
and they're not
lemon juice.
Bit too bitter for that
No. They take the oil, the kind of the oil
they take
rounds
on the profile
out the bitterness.
Of it. Now, what else have you brought in for us there?
So we've got loads of other ones in terms of dips, because I absolutely love dips. Muhumara. Muhumara is very
Never
trendy.
Heard of it.
Kind of, I mean, it's literally when I say new to the market in the last kind of 4 months, you'll start to see it appearing in the supermarkets. One of the supermarkets is kind of selling it already, I think. It's roast red peppers. So it's roast red peppers, breadcrumbs, walnuts, and again, lemon juice and garlic. Mm-hmm. Olive
now,
oil.
Do you want us to roast the red peppers, or are we
buying them? The jar. buy the jar. I don't have time for roasting red peppers, Claire. No. Buy the jar. But they come in a kind of a vinegary. It's not a pickle, but it's slightly like that. And sometimes when people take them out of the jar first off, if you say to somebody, get yourself a jar. Like, oh, I don't like those. It's what you're tasting is the liquor that they come in.
Yeah.
Rinse them. Just rinse them really well.
I kind of like that flavour though. If you're chopping them up for a salad, I like that little
edge. And it does
edge.
Add. It adds a little piquancy to kind of a dressing or a salad, doesn't it? Which is lovely. But I know some people don't. So again, food processor, breadcrumbs if you have them. If you didn't, that's okay. Bit of stale bread. But the walnuts. So it's basically roast red peppers, walnuts, garlic. Blitz that all up and it turns into this beautiful kind of deep red dip. It's like literally a dip. What I love to do is sprinkle a little bit of feta cheese over the top and pomegranate molasses. Now, I know that's a slightly different ingredient. And again, it's becoming more common in the supermarkets, but it adds that kind of sweetness. Because walnuts, when you talk about bitterness, walnuts kind of have that bitterness sometimes.
Yeah.
So you need a kind of the ping of the sweetness and a ping of the creaminess. So the feta and the pomegranate molasses will do that.
Lovely. Sitting down now eating too much at night with all these lovely dips. But anyway, we'll get over that.
We'll go another one.
Yeah, go with another one. Yeah.
I'm going to tell you actually about my Green Goddess dressing.
Yeah. So this is a salad dressing now.
Salad dressing.
Okay.
But also as a dip for veggies. So I find if I have a jar of it at home, I'm so much more likely to put a few carrot sticks or a few cucumber sticks or radish on the plate. Traditionally, it's sour cream and mayonnaise, half and half, right? But again, I'm always trying to maybe just make recipes a little bit better for us. Replace either the mayonnaise or the sour cream with live natural yogurt. Because it's good for your gut.
Fully in favour of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it's much lower in calories.
It's another one where we're tricking ourselves into
believing
it's something that it's not.
But it works. And I'm not saying no more mayonnaise. Because the mayonnaise adds a richness and a creaminess and the mouthfeel is lovely. But it is just that little bit of, I suppose, been clever about how you make it. So it's basically that. It's your Greek yogurt or your live natural yogurt with your mayonnaise or your sour cream. And then it's herbs. It's all these fresh summery herbs. Tarragon. Dill, basil, chives, parsley. Not dried, fresh.
Whatever you can get your hands on, you're telling me.
Exactly. Now. In the summer. It doesn't matter. What I would say is the big player is tarragon. You know when it's not there. you won't know that there's chives or basil or parsley. You can kind of get away with one of those, but you do notice the tarragon. So I'd say if you're going to do anything, you can use tarragon. And actually, I make it quite a lot. My sister rang the other day. She's like, can I use dried basil that's been in the press for a while? I was like, why are you using that? And then she was like, I want to put it into the Green Goddess. I was like, no, 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 don't do that. And then she said, I have to tell you a secret. I've been putting dried tarragon into your Green Goddess and I haven't told you. And I was like, does it work? And she's like, well, you've eaten it. And it definitely does work. So you can get away with the dried tarragon. Mm-hmm. And it means, I hate giving somebody a recipe where they've got to go and find a million things. The dried tarragon, you'll buy it once. It'll be in the store cupboard and you can just use the sprinkle of it every time.
Right.
So it's a lovely, lovely
So are
one.
You, let's say we are using fresh, are you just chopping that up or are you
yeah,
putting
it
in
a rough chop food processor? Again, every single one of these, it's dump into the food processor. So your sour cream will go in, your yogurt will go in, your mayonnaise will go in, your fresh herbs will go in, a little piece of lemon juice. And then the secret to a Green Goddess is anchovies. How do you feel about that?
Lovely. No, love them.
Do you?
Yeah, except I have to sneak them in. I can't. They can't even be seen in the house.
No, yeah. 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 But once you melt them down in a little bit of oil and nobody knows that they're just one, and it just takes one. And if you're incredibly allergic to the thought of an anchovy going in, Worcestershire sauce.
Ah, another great one. I love, I put it in everything, yeah. Gravies and everything.
Totally.
Again, don't tell anybody.
You don't tell anybody. No. But it works. And that's the beauty of it, isn't it? It adds that depth of flavour that we love. And I suppose sometimes the commercial products are made, they're made for margin, they're made for kind of stable shelf life. But when you make them at home, you have to be clever about how you get that flavour in.
Aisling, pleasure talking to
Thank you.
You're speaking my language. And a listener says tahini's also brilliant in a salad dressing or as a spread instead of butter. So I'll have to invest in that now and get working with the tahini.
TV chef Aisling Larkin on Today with Claire Byrne. Also on Today with Claire Byrne, producer and director Brian Redden and freelance arts journalist Aoife Barry told us what TV and movies to watch out for in the month ahead.
Wait, listen, we have this 28 years later. This is the follow-up to the zombie classic of 2002, 28 Days Later. Danny Boyle's
your
film.
Favorite genre.
No, see, just not for me. But anyway, go on.
But
tell us how great it is.
First of all, it's not a zombie film, right? So Danny Boyle is very clear in saying these are not zombies. Yeah. They're a bit like zombies.
They are.
They're flesh-eating mad people, but they're not quite. It's in the zombie genre. So it's 2002. The first one comes out 28 days later. And the premise is a great movie written by Alex Garland, directed by Danny Boyle. And it kind of revolutionized the whole zombie movie thing in that they weren't supposed to be zombies. The whole premise of it is this virus called the Rage Virus, right, which infects people and just, you know, increases your level of anger and rage, has leaked out from a lab and has infected the world. Cillian Murphy plays this bicycle courier and he gets hit by a car and he's in a coma. He wakes up 28 days later and the world has gone mad. So that was the first film. That was followed by a sequel called 28 Weeks Later, which wasn't as good and not the same people were behind it. But now here we have the third version of it with the same people behind it. So here we have Danny Boyle back directing, Agus Garland is back writing. It's called 28 Years Later. It's not quite 28 years after the first film, but close enough. And the premise of it is literally, it's the action takes place 28 years after the virus has been released into the public. And in this situation, a small group of survivors are living on an island, right? And the island is connected to the mainland by a causeway, which is heavily fortified. And then this young fella, this played by Aaron Taylor Johnson, a young father and his son decide to go over the causeway into the mainland and find out if people are still infected.
That was very
and then
thing.
All hell breaks loose. All hell breaks loose.
And are we to watch this?
Definitely. It'll be one of the really big ones, I think, this year.
You know, great and cast. The cast, like, Fiennes is in it.
Yeah, Aaron Taylor Johnson, who's always gives great. A good book on screen, and Jodie Comer. And Jodie Comer is actually what might be an interesting film to watch before that. She's in a film called The End We Start From. And at the end, kind of, you know, part of that film involves people who kind of have to survive an, you know, apocalyptic event that happens in the world. So there's a nice kind of themes that are going on there. I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's quite similar to what happens at the start of 28 Years Later.
I love everything she's
great.
In. She's just
fantastic.
So compelling
really,
to
watch,
isn't
she? Is. I think it'll be really good to see, you know, Danny Boyle, Alex Garland team up again. They always work really, do really great stuff.
And apparently Cillian Murphy may or may not be in it.
He's executive
he's one of the
producer.
Producers.
Yeah,
it,
he
right?
was in the first one, wasn't he?
Officially, it seems he's not in it. People did think he was because there was a character in the trailer with the really stunning trailer, which had this, you know, voiceover of the poem Boots by Rudyard Kipling. And there's a scene in it with a very kind of emaciated looking person who looks very scary, but bears a resemblance to Cillian Murphy. And everybody thought that was him. him, but it wasn't. It was actually a model from London.
Yeah, yeah. 19th of June. That's out. 28 years later. Now, this I was reading about this next one, an interview with Jerry Bruckheimer last week, the Formula One one called F1 with Brad Pitt, and he was obviously talking about how brilliant it's going to be, but he also told the story about getting insurance for Brad Pitt because he does all of the driving at 180 kilometres an hour on all of these tracks all over the world. And he was saying, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer is the ultimate marketing man, isn't it? All of the grimacing on Brad's face is for real because he was absolutely terrified in behind the wheel of the car.
Can you imagine?
What's the buzz around this?
Well, I was reading a really interesting piece. It was an interview with two of the people involved, one of whom is Lewis Hamilton, the other one is Tim Cook from Apple. And it was basically presented as this incredible branding exercise, but it's also presented as an amazing technological kind of feat. So what they did with it is they wanted to get into the car, get into that Formula One car with the driver who's played by Brad Pitt. He plays a guy called Sonny Hayes, who's a former driver who gets in a big accident and then leaves the sport and then comes back and is mentoring somebody. And they wanted to show like what it's like, what it's kind of like for somebody like Lewis Hamilton to be in the car. They were filming at actual Grand Prix races in 2023 and 24. They put all the technology into it. There was some line in it about some of the technology even being used in the future iPhones as well. So it's very much tying in this kind of Apple branding, Formula One branding, big, huge, massive star. It's going to be massive on the big screen. I mean, even someone like me who's not really interested in Formula One,
I'm not either,
I think we'll get like that speed and intensity. We'll get that out of it.
And there's a game as well linked to it. So you can see how they're trying to address the drop in people going to the cinema. Just make a big thing
definitely
out of it so that we're
all interesting. There's never really been a good Formula One movie, so it'll be interesting to see if they actually do this. You know, racing car movies tend to be very dull, even going back to when Steve McQueen was doing it. They're just, it's very hard to recreate that kind of excitement. It's a film that I'm not really interested in it at all. I have no interest in Formula
One. We'll force you to go and see it.
That's not really my bag.
They're going to bombard you with every single ad and every single platform.
But it doesn't look great. The trailer doesn't look that great.
I mean, it kind of looks like what you might expect from a film like this. Kerry Condon, the Irish actor, is in it, and it'll be great to see her on screen as well. Her kind of first big role. She was in another smaller film, but her first big one since The Banshees of Inisherin. And so, look, I think like people were out in force to see Mission Impossible. People will be out in force to see something like this too. And people are so into things like Drive to Survive. You know, all those people love Formula One, so there's a huge audience out there for a film like this. So it's really clever. They're banking $200 million+
on
it.
We'll be swept along, kind of forced to see this one, I feel, even Brian. Brian, you want to tell us about this new thing called Echo Valley on Apple TV. Julianne Moore and Sydney Sweeney.
Yeah, you're sick of the sight of Sydney Sweeney yet? I'm sick of the sight of Sydney Sweeney.
Is this the bathwater?
I don't know.
Yeah, this is the bathwater gal. She's like the Sabrina Carpenter of film.
She's just everywhere. Yeah. Absolutely everywhere. But can she act? I don't know. But judge
Does it matter?
It doesn't matter, no. But judging by this, it seems she can. This looks really interesting, right? So this is on today, actually, on Apple TV today. So it's called Echo Valley. And basically, so it's a thriller, right? And Julianne Moore plays this. So she works with horses and she's in a ranch and a farm in an isolated part of America. She's estranged from her daughter. I'm not giving anything away here because this is on the trailer. Her daughter, played by Sydney Sweeney, is a heroin addict. And she's estranged from her. And she turns up on the doorstep one day and she's covered in blood and it ain't her blood. And she happens to have a body in the boot of the car. So this is all about how far the mother will go to try and help the daughter to try to cover up this crime. So it looks really interesting. It's kind of twisty-turny thriller. It's got a great Irish cast in it as well. Fiona Shaw is in it. And brilliantly, Donald Gleeson plays a bad guy in it. You don't often see him as a bad guy.
No.
He's her drug dealer. He's the one who's got her hooked on heroin. He's the one who's been feeding her all this. And he might be, or he might not be, the guy who's dead in the boot of the car. We don't know. So it's basically how the mother helps her cover up this murder and the consequences of that. So it's kind of, it looks really good. It's a really good thriller. It's getting very good reviews. And it's on Apple TV from today. And interesting, it's written by the guy who wrote Mayor of Easttown, Brad Inglesby.
Which is great.
And Mayor of Easttown, remember that?
I enjoyed that.
That was brilliant. So it's got the same kind of vibes as that.
And in fairness, Sydney Sweeney, sorry, I know we were flippant there, but she was really great in Euphoria. So, I mean, just to be like,
this thing, I should explain the bathwater thing. Apparently, they're selling soap now that has a drop of her used bathwater.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so gross. I can't believe I'm saying these words. But there's obviously a
customer. Where do you get
customer
that?
I'll send you the link.
It's great branding for young actors. It's like try to get, you know, any sort of headlines, even if it is about something like that. It's all part of the game, I think, you know.
And Julianne Moore's really churning them out. I mean, she just saw Sirens, right?
Yeah, her Nicole Kidman turn.
There's an interesting twist with her. I won't give it away, but it's an interesting twist with the character. This, obviously, she's estranged from her husband, played by Kyle MacLachlan. And you find out in the course of the film why she's estranged from him. But so it's kind of got nice twists and turns in it. And by all accounts, Sweeney gives a great performance in it. You know?
And how is that out now on Apple TV? So
Apple
we can
TV
go and watch that tonight.
Watch it tonight.
If we wish.
Echo Valley, it's called.
So now we're on to Netflix and Titan, the Ocean Gate disaster. Oh, this is the story of the real life disaster that happened.
It is.
When the little submersible went down.
Exactly, when the submersible went down in 2023 and the globe was gripped by the story. You know, it took up a lot of attention that maybe could have been on other, you know, disasters that were happening in the globe. There's certainly a lot of layers to this. But this is interesting because a lot of times Netflix will do like a 6-part documentary series and there isn't enough, you know, in it for it to do that. So thankfully, it's just kind of a feature length documentary that it's done. And it basically, they speak to whistleblowers, former employees who worked with OceanGate, with Stockton Rush, the amazingly named you know, creator of the company and of the submersible who died in the disaster, along with four other guests who were down there with him. And you really get this picture of someone who, you know, believes in, you know, move fast and break things. This kind of tech titan idea of just keep moving forward. I have this mad idea and I'm going to do whatever it takes to make it happen. And there's a lot of people who were really, you know, they thought that was kind of suspect and they really didn't think enough was done to actually try and protect people and keep people safe. Mm-hmm. And it does paint a really damning picture of the company and also just a really tragic picture of lives that, you know, shouldn't have been lost and were in really horrific circumstances with, you know, the lenses of the globe.
So it's not trying to airbrush him, what he was like.
The complete opposite. I mean, he does not come out of it looking good at all. And I think a lot of people have been waiting for this opportunity who worked with him to actually have their say in what they experienced. So it really dives into that. And it does follow this, doesn't follow the kind of like building up to disaster. It does follow this, like, how did these things happen? And let's look at the kind of technical sides of it alongside the drama.
So now we're going to move, that's on Netflix.
That's on Netflix from now,
The Ocean Gate disaster. So we've comedy next on Amazon Prime. And you're hopeful that this is going to be really good. Have you seen it? It's deep,
deep
cover.
It's good fun. It's on again today. It starts today. So it's a really silly kind of a romp and a farce, but it's quite lighthearted. But I saw it. It's great though. I really enjoyed it. And it's getting fantastic reviews. So basically the premise of this is that Sean Bean is this London cop and he's trying to infiltrate a gang of counterfeiters. These guys are selling counterfeit cigarettes. Okay? So he wants to infiltrate this ring of counterfeit cigarette guys, whatever you call that. So he employs, implausibly, the services of three improv comedians. Forget about the cops. Let's get improv. In his mind, he goes, okay, so you got to go deep undercover. The cops weren't being able to do it. Let's get actors to do it. Guys who can improv and the guys who can improvise on the spot and make up characters, make up scenarios. So he goes to a comedy club and he finds three improv actors and he tasks them with the task of infiltrating this counterfeit ring and off they go. So they have varying degrees of, you know, of skills. So the lead one is Bryce Dallas Howard. She's good. She's great. She's a great actress. She's American, obviously. Orlando Bloom, who doesn't often do comedy, plays one of the actors who's going to infiltrate the mob as well. He thinks he's Al Pacino, so he wants to get into character. He wants to do deep dives into his character. What am I doing? Why am I here? And then, of course, the comic foil is Nick Mohammed, who's been brilliant in everything he's ever done, and he's useless at everything. Uh-huh. So you got these three actors who go undercover, and obviously things are a lot worse than they expected. So it's a caper, it's a romp, it's a crime thriller. It's got a lot of fun in it, a lot of good laughs in it. It's nice, simple humour. Okay. You'll enjoy it.
Brian Redden and Aoife Barry on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on Thursday's edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.